Welcome to the Hurricane Center podcast, produced by the Storm Science Network and part of the National Tropical Weather Conference. This podcast is made possible by USAA, the South Padre Island Convention and Tourist Bureau, and Plylox Hurricane Clips. Understanding risk in the face of natural disasters. Why we don't know how our homes will stand up in a storm. And how Hurricane Sally turned roads into rivers, shutting down two coastal cities. And why we could see it happen again. This is NTWC Live.
Good morning, everybody. It's Wednesday. It's August the 16th. Good to have you along for NTWC Live. What a program we have for you today. We've got so much going on in the tropics. We've got great guests today. It's going to be a fascinating show. Our shows, as always, are brought to you by USAA, also the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau. Of course, don't forget to mention Weather Boy and the Weather Company, the folks that make these programs possible each and every week so that we can be here with you live every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. bringing you a great program. I think today's show is going to be great. George Siegel is with us. We're going to talk about some resilience issues. Of course, he's the guy behind Last House Standing, so looking forward to that. And Alan Strum in Pensacola, who's been through a whole bunch of stuff in Pensacola and a good friend from the National Tropical Weather Conference and the only guy that's ever been on this program in a suit, so we appreciate that. So Alan's going to talk a little bit. Dr. Hal is with us this morning, Hurricane Hal. We'll get to Hal in just a little bit, get his GeoTrek update as well. And, of course, the former director of the National Hurricane Center, Bill Reed, who's been up since about 4:30 putting the tropical weather update together, which we'll get along with a little bit later on. But in the meantime, good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Tim. Man, you have very good vision. You actually know my dogs wake us up at 4:30 in this house. So kind of in a way, I've been looking at it since then and enjoying the heat, of course. We haven't been below 100 for highs since the 28th of July, which for northern Galveston County probably would be a record. We just don't have any data on that. Hobby Airport would be the closest long-term data for inland, and we're pushing it. We're probably going to be in the top three heat waves behind the 1980 and 2011 before it's all said and done. And people are wishing for something to come out of the tropics to give us rain and cool it off. And I always answer, be careful what you wish for. Okay, I'll talk a little bit about more the tropics after our first guests here. And I'm happy to welcome back to our show this year, George Siegel, as Tim already alluded to. He comes to us from Tampa, Florida, a place that's also sweltering this summer in the above normal temperature regime we've been in. And what I'm really intrigued about, George has his career has been interwoven with some of the same stuff many of our viewers are into, the newscaster, sportscaster, weathercaster world, been a reporter and a producer, and did the documentary film that we talked about last year. And now he produces a podcast, Tell Us How to Make It Better. So George, welcome to the show and tell us how to make it better.
I wish I could. I wish I had an answer for making everything better. And that's the goal of the podcast, to educate homeowners about things that they can do to make their situation better. And that ranges from understanding where you're living and what the risks are, which I would argue a lot of people have no idea, to understanding the house that you're living in. How safe was that house built? What could that actually withstand? To making sure you have insurance, to making sure you have flood insurance. And I go by the belief that most people are just very unprepared. We don't think anything bad is going to happen to us. So we don't do anything until something bad happens. And then we're going, why did this happen to us? How did this happen? And it doesn't have to be that way. So I just encourage everybody to do something to make it better. And that means you don't complain about your situation. You understand it and you do something to make it better.
That's interesting. Do you do you have any particular favorites you project people with, like before the hurricane season gets started?
Well, I'm amazed by how many people don't have generators, if you want to talk about preparation. I'm amazed how many people have no idea what the flood risk is where they live. I found out recently on a podcast that in Florida, they recently changed the law. So there's now a form for the seller of a property to put on if the house is flooded before, but they don't have to present it to the buyer. So I could be buying a house from you. Your house could have been under 10 feet of water 6 months ago, and you don't have to tell me. I think that's insane. That makes my blood pressure skyrocket. It makes my blood boil. It's like, wow. So I have a solution for that. Everybody ask. Ask the question. Excuse me, seller, has this house ever flooded before? Is there any history of flooding? Is there a risk of flooding? Make them put it in writing. I think people need to wake up and do everything they can to get as much knowledge as they can, because I certainly don't want to rely on a builder. I don't want to rely on a salesman of any kind. I want to know myself, because in the end, you just have yourself to blame if you don't have any information.
That's very good. There's some things going on in the insurance world and even in the research world to make it possible to punch in an address and get a history of the risk, just like a Carfax you get with a car. You know, there'll be a lot of cars go on the market after like Hurricane Harvey that had flood damage, and the Carfax system catches it. I think the same kind of thing might work for houses if we could just get the states to pass laws in accordance with that.
Oh, that would be incredible if you could actually make people accountable for the history of their house. You know, it's almost like the game of musical chairs or hot potato, where that house ended up with you because somebody tossed it to you. And now you've got all the problems that go with it. So if you buy a house from, like, I've had several home inspectors on, and I love talking to those guys because they talk about new home inspections where they find pipes that aren't vented through the roof. They just go up into the attic, or they find brackets that are upside down, or they find shingles that don't have flashing at the corner of a roof. I mean, so many things that people aren't aware of, but now it's your problem if you don't catch it. And so I just encourage everybody to be super vigilant. Don't not trust anybody, but at least be skeptical and make sure you inspect the hell out of everything. Make sure you know as much as you can about what you're buying, because once that disaster hits, you know, we see what's happening over in Hawaii right now. We see what happened down in Southwest Florida last year. We see Mexico Beach in my film. Those people's lives are changed forever. I mean, there's no coming back from that for many of the people that are victims in a disaster. And that just breaks my heart, because your life has changed forever. Why don't you do something to make sure at least it's not as bad if it happens? Try to do something to make it better.
Yeah, that's interesting. The feedback I get, because I'm kind of in the same realm that you are, I'm always trying to preach preparedness on that, is a lot of people feel overwhelmed. They're just too big a problem. There's too much they have to do. So I've actually simplified my entire plan, and whatever I plan to do, I've got it on three pages or less, mostly double spaced. So I leave out a lot that a detail person would like to have, but I try to show people you don't have to make this an impossible task.
No, you take it in baby steps. Just do something. Something is better than doing nothing. You know, it could be as simple as you have a go box in a closet and a list of things you would take if you had to evacuate. Mm-hmm. And I always say that if somebody said you had 10 minutes to leave your house, you would take 9 minutes thinking about what you wanted to take, and then you have no time to get anything. Well, people that have that list know, grab insurance papers, take the pictures of mom and dad, grab the yearbooks, whatever. If you plan, there's a reason first responders and emergency preparedness people practice all the time. The reason firefighters practice all the time. You don't want the disaster to be the first time you've ever thrown the fire ladder out the window or tried to evacuate with having no clue where you're going. You have to have a plan.
Yeah. And I use an old Navy thing I learned when I was in the Navy was, you make these plans knowing full well that things are not going to go as planned, but the process of making the plan will give you the intelligence to adapt as the event unfolds.
Yeah, that's one thing I learned from TV news. You have to think on your feet because they have a whole show produced, and then something happens at the top of the show and then everything changes. The plan is out the window. You know, you think you're prepared for a disaster, then a tree falls on your generator, or, you know, something slams into your house. So there's always going to be the necessity for contingency plans. But still, most people don't even have a basic plan. They're just relying on, oh, it's not going to happen to me. And, there's a great image we put in The Last House Standing, and from the movie The World According to Garp, where the airplane crashes into the house that they're looking at to buy. And Garp goes, "We'll take the house. Do you realize the odds of a plane ever hitting this house again?" And, you know, it's that attitude of, well, it'll be fine. Everything's going to be fine. And that shouldn't be the reason not to have a plan.
Yeah, well, it is human nature to be in basic denial of bad things happening. Otherwise, you'd probably have serious mental issues if you were constantly living in fear of all the things that could happen. But the builder part of it's interesting. You may have already done this. Have a house that's being built, and for one of your podcasts, go through it with a civil engineer that's qualified in building to resist wind and explain what works and doesn't work.
That's a great idea, because I don't know that most builders would necessarily tell you. I'm not a huge fan of the construction industry. If you've ever, anybody who's ever listened to the podcast knows, going from personal experience, I've never finished building a house where I then wanted to hang out with my builder or even run into him anywhere unless I was running over him. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, they're doing something so personal for us. It's our space. It's our castle. And, you know, you guys know Aris Papadopoulos. Aris and I are working on a new film called Built to Last, Buyer Beware. And it's, you know, people don't know what they're buying. You don't know what you're getting from that builder. You don't know what goes on in those rooms downtown at city council meetings where people are lobbying to keep building codes lower so the cost stays lower. You know, we just assume the house is okay. Hey, they're showing it to us. Look at all this cool stuff. Granite countertops. It has a nice backyard where the kids can play. They don't know that water, that backyard is going to be a swimming pool of 10 feet of water when the sewer backs up. They don't know that that house is wood on the second floor and not concrete block. And so they're not safe there in a hurricane. People just don't know, because we trust too many people. And so we're going to show in that film that the buyer needs to beware. You know, do you want to scare people? Well, maybe you have to scare them a little bit, because just saying do it on a nice sunny day doesn't really get through to a lot of people.
Yeah, we've talked in the past with the folks that that work the fortified system. You aware of that one?
Those people are great.
I really think that to change the equation on this is you've got to get a certain critical mass of builders that get it and buy into the fortified process of building.
And there's two houses that a builder is building across the street from me is Tampa Bay. And they're two houses that are probably $7 or $8 million each. And one house is built like a fortress, concrete block on both floors. The other house had wood on the second floor. So I figured, what the hell? I'm a nosy guy. I called the builder and I go, "What are you doing? Why are you doing that with a house that's right on the bay?" And he said, "Because that's what the buyer wanted." And I said, "Well, maybe you should have talked him out of it. It's not safe. You know, are you a builder or a rebuilder?" And people just don't know. So yeah, builders could really fix this tomorrow. We don't need building codes to be stronger. We just need builders to say, "Hey, that's enough. I'm going to build something that lasts." You know, these people have a 30-year mortgage. And I'm telling them I'm covering it for 2 years. That's insane. You know, if you think about how stupid that is, if I buy a car and I have a 5-year loan, I like to make sure I have a 5-year warranty. So at least for my 5 years, I'm good. Nobody has no builder goes, "I'm covering that for 30 years. You know, talk about skin in the game.
Yeah. And another part of the problem is there's a widespread shortage of qualified building inspectors in the municipalities. I think when our house was built, the city was, there was somewhere between 500 and 600 new houses per year being built. And there was one WIN certified inspector. Do you really think he's inspecting your house? You see, I had a friend who's a civil engineer, so I actually had him come out, and our builder was very open. He said, "Yeah," I asked him if I could do that. He said, "Sure, you can come out anytime you want. It's your house." And by the time it was done, my friend said, "You probably have the best built house in the neighborhood," because they knew you.
That's awesome. And I'm sure there's a lot of really good builders out there. So I don't want to just trash the entire industry. I personally haven't experienced it. A lot of people I know haven't experienced it, but there are a lot of houses that survive, and there are a lot of builders that are, they're built to code isn't their goal. Building to withstand the hazards is their goal. You know, built to code, to me, that's like a 4-letter word. That's not going to save you in a disaster. That's like saying, "Hey, I just did the minimum for you. Have a nice life. Here's your house." I want somebody that says, no, I'm thinking about that storm surge that's going to come in. We thought about 160, 170 mile hour winds that could blow your house down. That's the house I want to buy.
Hal, you're looking pensive there. You got a question or two for
George, I have to ask you, what's the hurricane risk perception where you live there in Tampa? And did that shift at all last year with the close call from Hurricane Ian?
You know, it shifted for about a minute because what happened was the forecasters all looked like they were scared that Ian was going to wipe us out. That would have been our worst case scenario. I think we would have had, you know, a million homes damaged in this area. We could have had 2 million people, they said, hospitalized. It was going to be catastrophic, much worse than what you saw in the Southwest. But I think people went, after the storm missed us, then all those meteorologists were now saying, well, that's what usually happens when the storm's coming up the coast. They tilt to the right and turn. It's like, well, why were you scaring the hell out of us for the last week? Why were we thinking this was the end? And the result is people go, see, it's not going to happen. There's a dome of safety over Tampa Bay. And that's not true. You know, when Ian was getting close and the water gets sucked out of the bay and you go over there, that's like before a tsunami. You know, it's like everybody's going, oh, that's really cool. And there's people walking around in the bay. You know, I don't know that anything changed after that. I didn't see a boost in generators. I didn't see any of my neighbors going, God, next time we're going to do this or do that. I think people just went, phew, dodged another one.
Well, it's interesting. We saw the negative surge with Hurricane Irma, saw it again with Ian. I mean, like you're saying, that just means it was a really close call and you got really lucky. From me, just traveling up and down the coast, I talked to so many people in places like Sarasota, Siesta Key. They said the native Indian burial grounds are going to protect us. We never get a hurricane hit here. I just heard these things again and again.
Yeah, there's that perception that we're going to get lucky. And, you know, that's what people felt. We used to go every year to Sanibel Island. And the condo that we stayed in was the southernmost property closest to the water. And I used to say to my wife, this place is just, this isn't going to be here forever. This is going to get wiped out. And then that next year it happened. That doesn't make me a prophet. That's obvious. And so you're building on an island like that, that's at sea level. And it's a southern facing island. I mean, what are you looking at? It's like there's no place I love more than Florida. I'm thrilled to be living here and I love the people here, but people don't take it seriously enough. And I'm fearful of that, especially when you guys get to the hurricane part of this broadcast and you show what's starting to kick up out there. It's going to be a scary next several months.
Yeah, George, after I did field work for Ian, I went to the Tampa Library and I read about the 15-foot storm surge in 1848 when it was just an army fort. I know it was a long time ago, but they took a very accurate measurement of a 15-foot surge coming in there. So we know it has happened in the distant past, you know, will happen again in the future. Tim, any questions coming in online?
Yeah, one question going back to flood insurance, and Castor wants to know, what's the best practice approach in talking to inland residents, not just right at the coast, but inland residents, about acquiring flood insurance?
Well, if you don't live in that X zone where they're saying, okay, you're going to get flooded, you have to have flood insurance if you want to have a mortgage. It's not that expensive to get flood insurance if you're not called a flood zone. And the best example for people is where all the people in Houston from Hurricane Harvey that had flooding. Those people were not in a flood zone. So I've had experts tell me for $300, $400, they could have had a flood insurance policy that would have made the difference between disaster and the hope of rebuilding your house. And that's what people need to think about. Just because it doesn't say flood zone, I'm right by the water, the people 5 miles inland, there could be an inlet there. There could be a dam near their house. There could be so many different ways that water could, with all the construction, water just gets diverted differently and could flood their house. Everybody should have flood insurance. My sister lived in a condo over here on Bayshore on the 12th floor, and they said, you should have flood insurance there because there could be things that could happen. You're not going to get flooded 12 floors up, but the lobby could get wiped out. You could be inconvenienced other ways in your life that policy might have coverage for you if water comes in through the windows or whatever. Everybody should look into having a flood insurance policy. It's your last line of defense.
Yeah, Hal, let me bring you back into this, Hal, because you made an observation when you were down there for Ian about how most cities you go into leading up to a hurricane, things shut down. But how you were in Florida and things weren't shut down. It was like a regular day.
I rolled into Sarasota, Florida, the day before landfall when the model showed that probably they would get a direct hit. I could have been in Cleveland. I mean, I drove around, the stores were open, people were driving around. I saw very little closed down or boarded up. I could go to Publix in down by Venice, like where it looked like they were going to take a direct hit. They were open till 6 p.m. the day before landfall. And I'm thinking, well, what about all the workers there? You know, they're not going to evacuate if they have to work the day before the storm. So I was just shocked. I showed up with food, water, and gasoline, and I really didn't need them. I could have bought them there. I mean, I just thought it would be a ghost town, and it wasn't at all.
People don't take that seriously enough. And we saw that on Sanibel Island and Captiva. There's one way off that island. And so if you live up in Captiva and you're told to evacuate or you should get out, if you haven't done it early, you may never get out. And what's one of the biggest causes of death in a hurricane is people that drown from storm surge. Brock Long told me there's a reason you don't hear stories from people that survive storm surge, because they don't survive it. You know, those people end up losing their life. I interviewed a guy on my podcast who lived in Tin City down in Naples, and he lived in a community where there were 20 houses. All 20 houses flooded. They all had to be rebuilt, and they rebuilt them to the exact same standard that they were before the hurricane. So if another hurricane came, it would just be repeating the same experience all over. Now, this gentleman was fortunate to get out. His next door neighbor died in the flood. So it's scary how we have short memories, how when we rebuild, to rebuild to the same standard, to me, is crazy if you see what the problem is. And when you talk about evacuating and taking those things seriously, you guys know as forecasters, what happens early in hurricane season when you tell people they need to evacuate and the storm misses, and then the next storm is coming. People go, nah, that guy was wrong last time. I'm not going to have to evacuate. People need to take it seriously.
Yeah, we're fine-tuning that evacuation process a little better. The forecasts are better at the longer lead time, so it reduces the amount of area that you have to move early by doing that. I always use Dr. Sheets had a great phrase for that. It says, in your lifetime, if you live here in X Beach, there's going to be four storms that I'm going to tell you to evacuate. Three of them I'm going to be wrong and nothing will happen. One of them, you're going to get wiped out. The problem is I can't tell you which storm that is in advance. And that's why you have to leave for every time they tell you to. I don't know how well that sticks with people, but it's always...
Well, if anybody's ever seen a disaster, Hal, if you talk about what, you know, anybody that went to Mexico Beach afterwards, we were up there with a drone and seeing all the damage. When you see just a slab of a foundation left and everything else is gone, that's the power of water. And how that can just sweep through and wipe things out. So if you're in that house when that happens, you have no chance of surviving. So when the experts tell you it's time to go, you need to really consider where you are and how that would survive if you don't go, because nobody's coming for you during the storm. And those are the people you see plucked off of roofs and, you know, on the news afterwards, and that are rowboats coming through neighborhoods to get them out. I think you want to do everything you can to avoid being in that position.
George, you know, it really, I think what a hurricane can do is so far outside of people's frame of reference. People think of the worst case in a hurricane, they have a palm tree on their house, right? And you're talking about, no, in the worst case, there's no house to come back to. It's just a slab of concrete, you know? So it's just, again, I think mostly when people view hurricane media, the media are filming palm trees blowing in the wind, because not that many people actually film a storm surge with huge waves crushing buildings and survive it. So I think it's just outside their frame of reference sometimes.
Well, the Weather Channel has a great graphic that they've been using the last couple of years of what's rising water and storm surge, when they show that 3D water arising around the meteorologist in the studio. And even that doesn't do it justice. It's scary when they show you what 4 feet of water, 8 feet of water, 10 feet of water. But for anybody who has a two-story house, imagine you can't go downstairs because there's 10 feet of water downstairs. Now, is the power out? What about the electricity if I step in that water? I mean, there's so many things that are frightening about staying in a disaster. That's why movies like The Last House Standing and other films that show, you know, maybe the ones that Hollywood makes, San Andreas, Twister, you know, people go, I can walk up to a tornado and throw something up in it and I'll be fine. Versus seeing a house just wiped out and taken away. You're right. People don't really understand it. Once you see it, it's something you never forget. It's unbelievable.
Interesting comment I saw online yesterday somewhere talking about the Maui wildfires and how they weren't ready, you know, and the warnings weren't there. But there was talk about spending the money to prepare for the outlier events and on a national or global scale. And it's just a comment that I read and interesting for discussion. Is it worth spending that money for that outlier event? For, you know, does everybody on the Gulf Coast, everybody on the Atlantic seaboard spend all that extra money for that one outlier event that happens maybe once in your lifetime, but probably even not? I just thought it was an interesting question that was posed. You know, we think the answer is yes, of course, but I don't know if there's any thought about that.
Well, if somebody said, hey, say you have a $1 million house on the water, and somebody said, you know, it's a $1 million house, for $1.2 million, you could still have that house. Maybe that's what the cost of having that house is, having a house that will survive. You know, to think that survive, you know, outlier events. Well, I haven't heard anybody say what they could have done differently in Maui when a firestorm sweeps through like that. It's like a tornado rolling through your neighborhood. You can have the greatest house in the world. If a EF5 or whatever, if the most powerful tornado moves through, your house isn't going to survive. You know, Roy Wright told me that. He goes, there's some disasters you're just not going to, your house isn't going to be safe from. Then that's where you needed to have insurance. That's where you needed to have an evacuation plan. So it all, one thing kind of feeds off of another. You can't protect everything. But I've also heard the talk, I'm curious what you guys think, that the people who live in those dangerous areas need to bear more of the risk than the people who live in the safer areas. It's like, if I don't live anywhere near any of that stuff, my insurance goes up either way. But I'm not benefiting from walking on the beach every night and, you know, having parties on my balcony. So who should be paying for that?
That is an interesting challenge.
Well, George, thank you. Thank you. It's been fascinating. We encourage you to stick around if you'd like for the next half of the program as well. Bill's going to give us a tropical update, and Hal's got a geotrek update. And then Alan Strum's going to join us to talk about things in Pensacola. He's here, been listening. And Alan, if you've got questions, by all means, throw them in here as well. But we appreciate it. Great information, George. And thanks for all you're doing in the resilience world and trying to help get people ready for those outlier events.
Well, thanks for having me on. I hope people check out the podcast, tellushowtomakeitbetter.com. And I'm sticking around because I want to hear about these hurricanes and potential storms. So I'll be glued to my seat.
Okay. All right.
Bill, thanks for that world tour there with tropical weather forecast. Wow, all the way from the Atlantic to the Gulf to even Baja California and California. It seems like a lot of impacts could be happening over the next week. Well, y'all, a quick update from GeoTrek. GeoTrek travels the world looking for stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. If you're an adventurer or an explorer, you are going to love our latest podcast, which just uploaded to Spotify and Apple Podcasts. It's podcast number 77, titled Extreme Weather and Aviation with Jonathan Frank. You're going to love this podcast. Jonathan Frank is a pilot. He's a captain of Boeing 777s, flies all over the world. He's also an accomplished artist. I got a really different view of extreme weather around the world from this podcast conversation. Jonathan's been based, he's flown everywhere, and he's been based in a lot of interesting places. He talked about what it was like to fly out by Guam and Micronesia when he was stationed out there and really based out there in the late 90s. He talked about how rapidly thunderstorms can develop in the tropical Pacific, much more than he really saw closer to the US or even in the Gulf Coast, and just how that can create a lot of changes really quickly to flight plans, but also to forecasting. So really interesting perspectives there. He's also flown over the Arctic and big mountain areas. I also got a changing perspective on the coastal flood risk from sea level rise from talking to him. You know, one of the big concerns with sea level rise are the melting ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. You can see scientific analysis on that. You can see models on that. But he talked about what it's like to fly over Greenland at 35,000 feet and to see the peaks of towering mountains sticking out from these ice caps that are thousands of feet thick. It really changed my perception on how much ice is really out there and potential impacts that could happen to our coastal areas as that ice melts. So again, check that out. That's podcast number 77 on the GeoTrek podcast, Extreme Weather and Aviation with Jonathan Frank. It just posted to the podcast sites yesterday. Yeah, we're also doing a partnership with Flood Information Systems. We're plotting out the building elevations for every building in Galveston Island where I live. We're going to be able to do address-based flood forecasting soon through this method of not only building out the flood history, but also building out all the building elevations. We have a team of around 25 students working with us to build these data. Exciting stuff there in that partnership between GeoTrek and Flood Information Systems. Y'all, back to you. I think we'll go back to Tim and Bill here. Just wanted to give you a little update there of what's happening in the world of GeoTrek.
Thanks, Al. We appreciate it. Of course, we appreciate the sponsors that make this program possible each and every week. We want to thank USAA. You know, USAA has been with us from the very beginning of the National Tropical Weather Conference and a lot of things we do with the Storm Science Network, including events for kids all over Texas. And we appreciate USAA for their continued support of NTWC, NTWC Live, and the Storm Science Network. Also, the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, the National Tropical Weather Conference held every year on South Padre Island. We've back in April of 2024 at the Courtyard by Marriott on South Padre Island. We hope you can join us there once again. Many of you have before. We hope you'll come again in 2024. The Weather Company, a big part of what we do, and Weather Boy. Thanks to Weather Boy for being a part of the program the last couple of years as well. Good to have Weather Boy and everybody there involved in our programs. We appreciate that. Okay, Hal, I think you've got the intro for Alan. We're ready to get to Alan Strum. I think you have that, so let's get to it. Let's do it.
Y'all, you're going to be excited to hear from Alan Strum today. Alan is the chief meteorologist for WEAR-TV in Pensacola, Florida. He played a critical role in keeping his viewers informed during Hurricane Sally, Michael, Ivan, and Dennis. He has the National Weather Association and American Meteorological Society seals of approval. Alan, welcome to NTWC Live.
Hey, thank you very much. It is good to be here. And yeah, I've been working the Pensacola weather for about 22 years now. So we've seen quite a bit come through. You mentioned Hurricane Ivan. That was back in 2004. And that hit on September 16th. And then we had Hurricane Sally was our more recent hurricane. And that hit, in 2020. And that was the same date, September 16th for Ivan and Sally, which are some of the more memorable ones here that we've had in the Florida Panhandle in this part of the area. So we're very close to Alabama up here in this part of Florida.
Alan, I know that Hurricane Sally 3 years ago surprised a lot of people in Baldwin County, Alabama, over there to Escambia County, Florida. Why were some people taken off guard by Hurricane Sally?
Well, I think just about everybody was surprised, and surprised might be the right word for it as the storm was coming. Of course, I cannot say that it was a surprise for me watching these systems, doing this for a long time. So you can never really be surprised by the weather and how it acts and how it changes. But what we had was a very, very slow moving system over the Gulf of Mexico. And all indications were that it was going to be shifting toward Louisiana. So we didn't have the steering factors. Nothing was really pushing it one direction or another. And it was just sitting to the south of us out over the Gulf of Mexico. And there were all the alerts and, the watches, warnings, et cetera, posted up around Louisiana. And then the storm actually hit on what would have been a Tuesday night into Wednesday morning. So it was Wednesday morning at about 4:45 in the morning that it actually made its landfall, officially Baldwin County, as you mentioned, which is a county in Alabama. Alabama has two counties on the Gulf Coast right there, little tiny sliver that makes its way down toward the Gulf Coast. And it was right around Gulf Shores that its official landfall was announced. But, the storm had that impact on the neighboring counties, which are in Florida, which are Escambia, Santa Rosa, and then to some degree a more minor impact in Okaloosa County. So it was a slow mover over there. With everyone looking at it officially hit on that Wednesday morning, but everyone's looking at this in the weekend. You've got Saturday and Sunday. And then the hurricane warning was issued for our local area here where Pensacola is on Monday before at about 4:00 in the afternoon with that particular advisory. That's when the hurricane warning came out. So everything just kind of shifted, toward the east with Hurricane Sally, and nobody evacuated. I mean, nobody left. So you have stories of people out. We have barrier islands here. We have stories of people out on the beach and stuff. They were very frightened, and many of them weren't here during Hurricane Ivan, which was back in 2004. So you've got a lot of people are moving to Florida, and it sounds like Texas as well. So they're moving here, and a lot of people just weren't used to that. So nobody had really evacuated. Everybody stayed put, and without power and such, and with the storm blowing during the overnight hours, they were frightened. So it was just one of those ones that was difficult. The the path wasn't clear from the start, and it was there was nothing pushing it along. So things kind of developed more, I guess, quickly, and it ended up being a total direct hit for us.
Sure. Alan, you know, probably most people in your area, I'm guessing if they had to choose the worst storm in this past generation, it would probably be Ivan in 04. Could you walk us through just what it was like to live through that and forecast Ivan as well?
I never knew I would live through something like Hurricane Ivan. I started here in 2001. Ivan was a direct hit. It was a Category 3 hurricane that hit our area. As Sally that we've been talking about, the more recent one in Category 2. So Hurricane Ivan came through, and I mean, it was another one. It was during the overnight hours. You know, it was a September storm. It started way out off, you know, it was a wave off the coast of Africa, just rolled all the way up through the Caribbean and then just, you know, right up toward us. And in that case, with the cone, even though then the cone was much broader and much wider, really the forecast was pretty good, had a pretty good idea of where it was going. And then it was headed our way. So there was certainly time to prepare for that storm. But once, you know, I just had never experienced anything like that. I had experienced Fran and Bertha in the Carolinas, you know, as I was just getting started in the 90s and in basically the mid 90s. But this came through. It just, you know, took off roofs. It did a lot of damage along the immediate coastal areas. Damage was well inland. Power was out for some people for weeks. I mean, literally like 3 weeks is about kind of the max. You know, I was without power for 5 days. There was no running water. I mean, it was totally a war zone. And then after the fact, too, you know, with a scenario like that, Hurricane Ivan, you know, buildings are burning down. People are falling off ladders. I mean, it's just like the story just keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. Even though the skies are clear, things just kind of take so long to get better, if you will. Yeah, you've taken me back to a time that was pretty rough. I don't ever see that again here in this area, but we saw it, you know, just to the east with Hurricane Michael.
Well, Alan, you mentioned how many people moved to Florida too, and it seems like it had been quite a long time before that area of the coast was really hit pre-Ivan, right? So I'd imagine with Ivan, for a lot of folks, that was probably their first hurricane, right?
Yeah, we did have some that were before I got here. It was Aaron and Opal, which were back in the 90s. And those kind of those when I first got here, those are the ones that people talked about. So they had some experience with them. Nothing like a Hurricane Ivan. But yeah, Hurricane Ivan came through. Anybody that was here for that remembers it, knows it well. We did have a lot of people evacuate for it and then come back to find the damage that they, you know, they had to deal with. We also had a lot of people stay for Hurricane Ivan. But for Hurricane Sally, basically nobody evacuated. Everybody stayed. Everybody thought, okay, it's going over there. And it just kept shifting. And then at that point, I don't really think there was much of a chance for people to leave for Hurricane Sally. So they ended up really not enjoying being here for that, you know, depending on where they are and were. But, you know, that one, of course, knocking out power as well. But yeah, Hurricane Ivan was the one that left a huge mark on this area. And that was back during very busy hurricane seasons, you know, in 04 and 05. That was also the time frame of when we had Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, I know a lot happened then. You know, before I switch over to Bill and Tim, I have to ask you, what are your plans this year on September 16th? Hopefully
well,
not a hurricane.
Celebrate. that's for sure. But yeah, we'll you know, it'll come up and we'll talk about it. So yeah, it's Sally is the one that is really kind of more in people's minds as it was a more recent one. But it, like I said, anybody who's been here with Ivan, you know, we're looking at that. We're forecasting it's the same landfall location as well. Same landfall location, same date of September 16th.
You know, in Southeast Louisiana, it's interesting. There's Katrina, Isaac, and Ida all on August 29th. Sometimes you just see those clusters hit on anniversaries. You know, it's a reminder, really, that, you know, a lot of these patterns do repeat along the coast.
Yeah. And then, you know, people ask me too, they say, why do they hit at night? You know, and I say, well, they don't. They hit when they hit. But it just happened that, you know, with Sally and with Ivan, they were the worst part of it was during the overnight hours, which just makes it much more frightening for people. Very different ways that we're broadcasting those from, you know, back in 2004 to 2020 with Sally, in the sense that the way people are getting their information is so much different, where it was radio and TV back in 2004. That was about it. We weren't streaming for the people that evacuated like we are now. Now we're streaming. And of course, you know, as we know, people are getting their information off of the social media sites. And a lot of times it's not the best information. But there's, yeah, so now people can leave and still take us with them. But it's just totally different and, you know, so much more online.
Sure. Bill, you have any questions over there?
Oh, yeah, that's a fascinating discussion. The the nature of the population where you live is there's a large military presence, the large naval presence. That by definition means you get a huge turnover in people living there. So you have a fairly large segment of your population that were coming there now that haven't experienced a hurricane. Do you have a special way of addressing that when you get people ramped up for the hurricane season or the approach of a storm?
Yeah, so here in Pensacola, we have NAS Pensacola, big base. Blue Angels are based out of it. And then we have the Eglin Reservation as well, where with an Air Force base there too. So the military presence is huge here. The military tends to do a pretty good job of shifting and moving their equipment, their aircraft and things like that. So I think they're the ones that are primarily sort of alerting their folks and sort of instructing them as to what to do. But I know a lot of military folks. There's a lot of wonderful young people that come to this area to start their career, as they come from all over the country and in some cases all over the world. I mean, we have people that come to NAS Pensacola from other countries to study and learn. Flight training and things like that. But they're not, yeah, a lot of, in many cases, they're not familiar with or have any idea what major hurricane or even, say a category one or two hurricane can do. So there's people that are moving here. There's the military folks and we try to educate them as much as possible, via our channels and such in our hurricane programs. But certainly unless they experience it, I don't think you really have a true understanding of how devastating it really can be.
Yeah. My not so fond memory was Hurricane Opal. I wasn't working in your area, but I was following it fairly closely and it went rapidly intensified coming out of the Bay of Campeche into the Central Gulf. And people were waking up at the crack of dawn the day it made landfall facing a high end Cat 4 storm. And it ended up being an aborted evacuation. They tried to evacuate, but they didn't have the time. And they just got lucky. The storm weakened rapidly right before landfall. And that may have played some role in planning for evacuations there. How much lead time do you think they need to get a major hurricane evacuation for your area?
Yeah, I think back in those, I've seen the images of a lot of traffic with those. We've had a lot of changes now. I mean, there are more people here, but we've also had a lot of changes with some of the roads and some of the evacuation routes where they're now much wider. From some of those ones that were two lane highways, we now have some four lanes that are just going, north, right out of the area, right out of Escambia County, some channels out of basically Santa Rosa and Okaloosa County. So how much time would we need to evacuate? Oh, that's a great question. It's tough too. A couple of days, maybe. I think, after Hurricane Sally, you all were discussing earlier about people, and maybe saying that one out of four times you'd need to, or it would actually, the evacuation would have been worthwhile, if I could put it in those terms. Maybe a couple of days to get everybody out. I think people don't like to leave and then feel like they left for no reason. So I think that is always a problem. But we try to message also that, hey, we haven't had an evacuation in a long time. So maybe my experience is a little bit limited in how that would go. But of course, that would start with the barrier islands and then it would work its way inland, depending on, the different zones and which zone you're in for that, mainly, of course, due to flooding.
Yeah, you can get out of the surge zone fairly quickly there. The challenge is there isn't a whole lot of places to put people till they go farther inland, I suspect.
Yeah, we do have a lot of, we've dealt with some pretty extensive flooding around here as well. We had back in 2014, we had around 2 feet of rain. And even earlier this year, we had in some reports around a foot to 15 inches of rainfall around the area. In 2014, it did cause, the flooding was much more severe than it was this year. And they'd done some infrastructure work too that may have helped with that. But there's areas in downtown Pensacola and, you know, up in Santa Rosa County, many areas that will, with a surge, with heavy rains and a surge, we're going to have flooding, and it's going to be getting into people's homes with a very, very serious storm coming through the area. But I do think after Hurricane Sally, anybody, you know, that was here in 2020 and experienced that, certainly when those evacuation orders do come or when there's that threat, I think they're going to be thinking, hey, I remember Sally. I don't want to go through that or anything like it or anything worse. I'm going to go ahead and leave. Yeah. But our barrier island for Sally, there was one young woman I was talking to here who was saying, this was worse than Ivan. You know, I can't believe this. You know, was surrounded by water and a surge and was just frightened overnight. Hard to tell them, well, actually, no, Ivan was much worse, believe me. But for them, for the person who's out there, the wind's howling and there's nowhere for them to go because they're surrounded by water in a place that's on pilings. That's a worst case scenario. That's a bad storm, and it can get much, much worse. If it's stronger, it's going to carry that structure right away and right off those pilings or foundation.
Alan, before we go over to Tim for some online questions, I wanted to ask you, one of the big differences between Ivan and Sally was that Sally was just moving so slow. How did that impact the flood and wind impacts there?
Well, it was a huge rainmaker too. So, but it was a slow mover, but we didn't end up with storm damage well inland or in some of the areas that it experienced it, say back during Hurricane Ivan. But the barrier islands, they had it, the water came up over, it was up over the beaches and places like that. But being the slow mover, just because it was such a slow mover that still everyone had the idea that it was going to be going, it's going to Louisiana, it's going to go that way. And it just kind of kept creeping up into the area. And just for, being such a slow mover, you just have more time for that wind to be doing damage to rooftops and things like that. So it's just spending more time over the area instead of quickly kind of moving on and out. And then also for Southwest Alabama, for some of those counties that expected more of a direct impact from that, it was like you were discussing too with the surge. It was like that was reverse surge out of Mobile Bay. So, the water is going the opposite direction out of that in an area that was where the forecast had called for a significant surge up into Mobile Bay. But in fact, it was quite the opposite. So the people there in Daphne and Fairhope and, Mobile thinking, hey, what's going on with this? We're expecting a surge and we're seeing the opposite.
Alan, thanks for sharing your memories and perspectives with us. Tim, do we have any questions that came in online?
Yeah, we do, and it kind of follows on what you're just asking about, and that's especially for newer residents of the Florida Panhandle. The slow movement caused a really extended period of heavy rainfall. Did that create any panic, amongst these new people who are going, oh my gosh, this never ends, did that cause any problems?
Well, yeah, I do think, and that's a lot of the questions, I get as I'm looking at my email. I did about 24 hours nonstop of broadcasting the storm, we're just on the air going. And it was about 24 hours, and it was like it took that long. So you're getting a lot of the feedback from the people. And yeah, it's like, when is this going to end? And you're trying to give them an idea and a time frame, and they don't like the answer because it's moving so slowly and it's taking so long. I mean, fortunately, it does. It did start, it had a nice, well-defined eye as it was moving on up along the coast. And then that, really started to quickly fall apart. And, it kind of all that movement, and the winds were just quickly weakening, but still it wasn't quickly moving along. This thing is 2-3 miles per hour and just sitting. So, it just made for really, it's just an incredibly long night for the folks that are just riding this out without power and, waiting for, just to use their generators or using their phones or whatever means they could get to try to get the information.
I found here in South Texas, the same kind of thing. When a storm's coming in, the first question you start getting is, when is it going to get here? You've been talking about this for a week. And then the last 24 hours, it's right there knocking out the door. When's it going to get here? And then all of a sudden it switches to, when's it going to go away? And it's interesting, that perspective.
Oh yeah, and it was definitely heavy on the, when is this going to go away? Why is this not stopping? With phone calls, with email, with messages on social media, or however people were able to get their message out, and it felt like for us as well, like, yeah, when is this going to end, and what are we going to see when we get out there? But it, it, the They had issued, the National Hurricane Center had issued a hurricane warning, like I mentioned, at 4 o'clock on the Monday ahead of it, that included the area that was under a direct hit. That was on the Monday. And then it was a Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, sort of worst part landfall occurrence, with it making that landfall at 4:45 in the morning on Wednesday morning. So there is, you know, there was that time, but not as much time as everybody would have liked. And of course, that hurricane warning would have come out sooner had there been a better idea, had it been a more quickly moving storm, had there been more steering currents for it, had we had a better idea of when that was going to, where it was going to end up going. And I want to mention, too, while we're here, I often mention this as well, that the National Hurricane Center is what we use their information and our local Weather Service office as well. But when it comes to these hurricanes, sometimes people will ask, hey, what is your gut on it? Or what do you think? Or, what is the National Hurricane Center not telling us? And I tell them that, we don't have any secrets. We're not hiding anything. And the information that I'm using is coming from the National Hurricane Center. They've got a team of people down there. And I really kind of look at my job as relaying those experts' information and translating it if need be and passing it along to the folks around here. So I'm not putting out my own warning. It's, when the National Hurricane Center on 4 o'clock that Monday afternoon said there's a hurricane warning, that was the deal. Here's what's up. Here's what we need to know. And it looks like this thing could hit us, even though at that time still there was the belief that it wasn't going to head our way.
Let me ask you one more question then, George, if you want to jump back in. I know as a podcaster, you've got questions as well, so I'd love for you to be part of this. But let me ask one more, and that's, Ivan was the most recent experience. Now Sally's the most recent experience. Did Sally change people's perspective, in general, people in the community?
Oh, I think it most definitely did. Yeah, we had back in 04 and 05, like when Hurricane Ivan hit in 04, we actually did have a follow-up storm, another Category 3 that was Dennis, in 05. It was a tighter, smaller storm, and it impacted. It was just a little bit to the east, but it was still our core area. And it was less than a year after Ivan, and it came. Ivan was September, and Dennis was in July. So it was like we were still picking up after that, and maybe allowed for us to kind of, we were kind of almost like used to this kind of lifestyle. But then we went a long time, we'll have, a tropical storm here or there run through the area. But it was a long time without something serious. And then we had Sally come along, which really to me didn't feel anything like a Hurricane Ivan, not at all. But it was absolutely, I think anybody that experienced Sally, just a total wake up, and the fact that nobody left and a lot of people decided, hey, I don't want to deal with that. I will certainly leave the next time around. But maybe in some cases they might say, hey, I was able to ride Sally out and I think I want to stay. But the next storm could be far worse than what Hurricane Sally was. I hope not, but it's possible.
George, you've been sitting quietly over there and listening to all this, and I know you've got some thoughts or comments on it, so please jump in.
Yeah, when you're talking about evacuations, what we saw during Ian here, a lot of people in Tampa, when we were the bullseye, evacuated to Fort Myers, or they evacuated to Orlando. Those places ended up getting more of the hurricane than we did here in Tampa, and that's the challenge of living on a peninsula. I know up where Alan is, they have more options of where you could go. If you're evacuating Tampa or somewhere in the peninsula of Florida, you really have to know where you're going and whether that place is going to be safer than where you are. And that seems to be a common problem. So that's why on a nice day, have a plan of where you might go if you had to evacuate. Do you have friends that live up in Tennessee or friends that live up in Georgia? But Alan, you could probably say once those storms move inland, a lot of those places end up getting flooding that could be as bad as where you're leaving from.
Yeah, and I always, I like to say, with my family, I suggest, look, go west. That's usually the best direction to go, and you don't sometimes have to go as far. If you go east, that strong side of the storm, because typically, in most cases, they're going to be coming up from the south, and it's that eastern portion of the storm. Like with Hurricane Michael, that was just down in, not that far away down in Panama City, but for the Pensacola area, basically no impact. It was, everybody was ready for the potential that Hurricane Michael would come here, but there was just basically no impact. But yeah, we have, you go west, you go north, and now that's kind of some of the recommendation is just get out of the flood zone, go to, somebody's place that's safe. You know, not necessarily go far away, but I still suggest like the best thing for, you know, anyone is just to get way outside of the path of the storm. It's just not a pleasant experience. And oftentimes there isn't much you can do, you know, in the immediate time frame after the storm strikes.
Great stuff, guys. We're running out of time. It's coming up on the top of the hour. So I want to jump around the horn real quick and see if anybody's got some final thoughts. Let's start with George. Jump in. What are your thoughts? What have people learned? Where are we headed?
Well, I learned your forecast was scary when I was seeing that. You know, I think we have to keep our eyes open over the next several months and don't risk your life. Be safe. If the experts, if your local meteorologist tell you it's time to go, get out. But do some planning now so you have something in your mind of what you would do. It's very hard to plan when you're panicking.
Alan, any final thoughts today on what you've been through in the recent years and where we're headed?
Well, and you know, another thing too, is I always like to point this out, is that our number one weather killer here across the Northern Gulf Coast, it's rip currents. And we fortunately had a pretty good season over the last couple of months during our peak season. The Gulf was very calm. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's crystal clear. You can see the fish and the marine life. I saw a seahorse recently. But when we have a tropical system, you know, it could be headed to Texas. It can be out there over the Gulf. It can be just some other type of weather maker or kind of storm system that will cause rip currents. And that's our number one weather killer here. So I always try to reach other people. And if there's anybody, you know, from not around the Northern Gulf Coast is watching, you know, it's getting the word out. Most of the people that die here are from out of town. They're usually tourists. They don't understand the risk with the rip currents here across the Northern Gulf Coast. So that's really kind of one of my struggles here is seeing people come in town to enjoy and oftentimes leaving without a family member or a friend. And it can be caused by a tropical system. It could be caused by some other sort of weather system. So that's something I just wanted to take a moment to just put out there, because that is our number one weather killer. If anybody has a way to, you know, educate folks from out of town that do decide to vacation on the Northern Gulf Coast and come to the beaches, just know we have a flag system. Follow it. When the red flags are out, that means that the Gulf waters are close to swimming.
Alan Strum, WEAR, thank you for your thoughts and your time today. We really appreciate it being with us today. Hurricane Hal Needham, final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I learned so much from both George and Alan today. George, amazing insights and perspectives on resiliency there. And then Alan, just what I really got from you is that, Sally, you didn't have a huge fatality account, but it was a big wake-up call. And sometimes there's value in that to say, hey, that was just, you know, maybe in a given area, maybe Cat 1 winds or even upper tropical storm force winds, but maybe a wake-up call for people that have never seen anything like that before.
Good stuff. Bill Reed, last word.
Okay, the message I get best out of this was from Alan on the radical difference between Hurricane Ivan and Hurricane Sally. There's a bit of a challenge in using past storms to educate people as to what will happen. Every storm's kind of different. Some of them are radically different, and we have to get creative in our ways of describing that to people so they'll know the difference when that happens.
Great stuff, gentlemen. Thank you so much. I think what I learned today was that we're going to have a lot to talk about next week at this time, because there's a lot going on out there right now. We'll know what that system in the Gulf is doing. We'll see how Hillary affects the Baja Peninsula and also Southern California, perhaps. So some significant impacts coming up in the next week. We'll have a lot to talk about next Wednesday morning. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us. All of you at home, thanks for being with us today. Thanks to USAA, to the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, to the Weather Company, and to Weather Boy for being part of this program every single week, NTWC Live. And we hope to see you all live on South Padre Island in April of 2024. That's it for today. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. with another exciting episode of NTWC Live.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of NTWC Live Hurricane Center Podcast. If you did, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. And join us next week. This is NTWC Live.